Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, September 5th. I'm Sigurd Bjørn, reporting for KMOD. In tonight's news, the spread of the Dillon fire slows down while the Blue fire grows by 20%. Former Yurok tribe employee pleads guilty to embezzlement charges. Fortuna City Council reconsiders cannabis sales. And a local football team snaps a 21-game losing streak. Stay tuned, these stories and more coming up. Jessica Engel of Gold Hills, Oregon, has pleaded guilty in federal court to embezzling close to $600,000 from the Yurok tribe. Engel was indicted by a federal grand jury in September last year on charges of embezzlement and theft from programs the tribe received from federal funds. She pleaded guilty on both counts. At the time, Engel served as the chief executive officer of the Yurok Telecommunications Corporation, which is owned by the tribe. She faces a maximum 10-year prison and a $250,000 fine for theft from programs receiving federal funds. Engel's prosecution was a result of an investigation by the FBI with assistance provided by the Yurok Tribal Police. The Dillon fire west of the Klamath River in northwest Siskiyou County has been active for 11 days now. It's grown to over 10,300 acres, an increase of a relatively modest 1,000 acres overnight. Containment stayed at 21%. For reference, the Dillon fire was 4,000 acres and 0% contained a week ago. Another 200 personnel have been added to the operation, now totaling 760 people. They have managed to establish strong containment lines on the northeastern perimeter and to the east along the Klamath River. However, as Stuart Turner, fire behavior specialist with the California Interagency Incident Team, explains, the main issues the firefighters are dealing with are along the south and west perimeters.
On the southwest corner of Rock Creek, that's still backing down that slope with some rollouts and some spotting. The rollouts are pine cones or logs that are on fire, and they start rolling down those steep slopes and then start a new fire down in the green fuels. So that's continuing to happen there above Rock Creek. As we move to the west side and Cedar Creek, that continues to back into Cedar Creek, it crosses Cedar Creek, and then it starts to run up the other side of Cedar Creek. When it gets to the ridge top, then it throws some spots out there. So that will continue to happen today. On the northwest corner by Dillon Creek and Cedar Creek, that continues to grow. That has pushed up a slope, and now it's going to cross that slope and slowly work its way down that, but following that Dillon Creek area. To the north, it's throwing spots across the Dillon Creek into the old burn scar. That burn scar, the fuels are such that it's not really receptive to moving fire around in it. There are some fuels in there that catch on fire, but they just don't enlarge or grow in size out there. And that's what we're seeing with the spots that came out a few days ago.
Intermittent closures of Highway 96 are still possible, particularly near Syed Valley. And the forest closure order in the vicinity of the Dillon fire is still in effect. Yesterday's evacuation zones remain the same as they have done for most part of the week. There are no reports of destruction of property. To the northeast of the Dillon fire, the Blue fire has increased by 20% overnight to 2,600 acres and remains 0% contained. The fire is into its 10th day. Smoke impact today has been following a similar pattern to yesterday's, and this trend is expected to continue tomorrow, Saturday. Here is Air Quality Resource Advisor Sarah Cofield.
We are seeing a return to those conditions you might have noticed on Sunday and Monday of this week, where there's that southwesterly breezes that are pushing the smoke in a certain direction, and that led to a really distinct pattern. Smoke started infiltrating into a lot of our areas kind of late morning, early afternoon, before lifting up in the afternoon, and we're going to expect that to continue. So in areas really south, nearby, but south of the Dillon Fire, it's going to be in that unhealthy to up to hazardous air quality conditions. As you go further south, not as bad, seeing down into Hoopa, some moderate to maybe unhealthy for sensitive groups, but then improving again in the afternoons.
Hamburg, to the east of the Blue Fire, will continue to see unhealthy conditions. Solms Bar, to the south of the Dillon Fire, has seen very unhealthy conditions today. Conditions are expected to improve tonight, but unhealthy air may return in the morning and early afternoon before cleaning up. Sunday and early next week are expected to bring additional clouds, which could cause smog to persist. However, potential for rain is also possible, which could provide reprieve. For more information on smog outlook and air quality, see wildlandfiresmog.net. That's wildlandfiresmog.net. A link to a virtual community meeting set for 6 p.m. on Saturday can be found at the Facebook page of the Six River National Forest. Although public opinion seemed to suspend Fortuna City Council's consideration of legal cannabis sales, the council is still open to the possibility of allowing it. Daniel Mintz reports.
Fortuna continues to consider allowing cannabis businesses in the city, a move that could generate much needed revenue, but is controversial and faces challenging market conditions. An ongoing series of discussions continued on September 4th when the City Council fielded a presentation from Mark Lovelace, a senior policy advisor with the HDL Company's consulting firm. Lovelace served as the county's 3rd District Supervisor from 2009 to 2016 as, quote, "We were looking at coming legalization and the impacts it could have on our industry and our economy." HDL's clientele is exclusively made up of local governments seeking information on cannabis economics. Fortuna could allow a range of cannabis businesses, including cultivators, and Lovelace said total annual retail cannabis sales in Fortuna could range from $3.5 to $5.5 million. Based on that estimate, he outlined what the city can expect if it allows cannabis businesses and levies a voter-approved tax on them.
We anticipate the city could receive between $180,000 to $320,000 in cannabis tax revenue, depending on the rates. Again, this is a very rough estimate only. Actual gross receipts can vary depending upon the business models of the businesses. This estimate assumes a range of assumptions for the size of the customer base and total sales, with rates ranging from 4% to 7%. The city would also generate an additional around $82,000 or so from sales and transaction taxes on those purchases. So moving to that policy discussion, the city currently prohibits cannabis businesses, and unless the city takes action otherwise, that existing prohibition stands. The only question the city needs to consider at this time is whether or not there's a desire for change.
Detailing the bigger picture, Lovelace described California's cannabis market as oversupplied. The vast amount of product from about 8,000 cultivators is funneled through the state's 1,800 licensed retailers. The supply-demand imbalance has driven prices down by an average of 35% since 2020. Most of Humboldt's retail cannabis sales are in Eureka and Arcata, which have a combined 31 retailers. The revenue estimates were met with skepticism during a public comment period, and 2nd District County Supervisor Michelle Bushnell, who is a cannabis cultivation permit holder, said the county's Measure S cannabis excise tax hasn't panned out as expected.
The county right now is not budgeting any cannabis excise tax because we can't depend on it, and we're currently actually at zero for our excise tax. So the Board of Supervisors is not charging the community because they're not paying. We're outstanding $14 million that is owed for excise tax. and the amount of cannabis cultivators that are not cultivating right now and still following their permits are large. I think there are currently around less than 600 farms in the unincorporated area. It is something that is very difficult right now to budget, to depend on budgetarily. And I know Riadel had thought it would be something that they could really depend on, and it did help them for a while. They have one cultivator there that in the business park that does pay, but is not something that they are able to really count on any longer either to help them budgetarily. And the two dispensaries they had, one closed, and they have one currently left. So it's a very volatile business in Humboldt.
Council members supported at least considering cannabis as a revenue generator, but Council Member Tammy Trent said community opinion is split and it should go to a public vote. Other council members were open to making the decision pending more public comment. Using the example of alcohol sales in Arkansas, Council Member Kyle Conley said if Fortuna doesn't serve local demand for cannabis, another city will.
I would keep coming back to when I went to Arkansas to visit my family in Arkansas. They have counties that don't sell alcohol. Everybody drove to the next county that wanted to buy alcohol. So it's just because your certain county doesn't like something or city doesn't like something doesn't mean that people in that city or town are not going to partake in that. And I think we're just missing out on whatever revenue that might be because the industry will provide that industry. I personally believe it should be a market type thing where the market says what should be out there because that's how business works. But I definitely want to keep exploring the options and looking into what we can find out.
The council wants to field more public comment and directed staff to develop a budget estimate for holding facilitated public meetings and workshops. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Thank you, Daniel. The House Natural Resources Committee held a field hearing today in Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming to discuss reauthorizing the Great American Outdoors Act, which funds maintenance on public lands like Yosemite National Park. Susan Potter reports.
A bill to fund maintenance on public lands goes before the House Committee on Natural Resources today at a field hearing at Grand Teton National Park. The Great American Outdoors Act, which passed with bipartisan support during the first Trump administration, is up for reauthorization. Emily Dowse with the National Parks Conservation Association says the law has funneled more than $6.5 billion to national parks like Yosemite to fix a range of issues.
A lot of these facilities, whether it's a visitor center or waste or drinking water systems or trails or campgrounds, you know, they were built 60 years ago and they need an upgrade.
Over the past few years, crews overhauled Yosemite's water system and installed new picnic tables, fire rings, and bear-proof food storage at the park's largest campground. Nationwide, the projects employ around 17,000 people. National parks attract more than 330 million tourists, contribute over $55 billion in economic output, and support 415,000 private sector jobs each year. Dowse says the Trump administration's extensive cuts to the Park Service workforce this year are making it difficult to manage maintenance projects.
24% of permanent employees have been let go since January, and it is important for this work to continue. This progress will likely be compromised if the staff don't get replaced and the reductions in force go forward.
The Great American Outdoors Act established the National Parks and Public Legacy Restoration Fund 5 years ago to handle deferred maintenance at the National Park Service, the U.S. Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Bureau of Indian Education. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A new report on school bullying surveyed 200,000 students and finds that positive role modeling by staff can be very effective in combating the problem. Here is Susan Potter again.
A report out today finds that school culture can go a long way to reduce bullying. Researchers from the nonprofit Youth Truth surveyed 200,000 students, K-12, and found that victims of bullying are more likely to turn to adults at home rather than at school, and less than half of U.S. students in grades 3-12 feel a sense of belonging at school. So, David McKinney with Youth Truth says schools need to intentionally foster a civil, friendly, open atmosphere.
When students see adults modeling respect, rates of bullying drop. They are less likely to say that they have been bullied or that they have witnessed bullying when they see adults treating other adults and treating kids with respect.
Students tend to feel more comfortable when they have something in common with their teachers who act as positive role models. The study also found that Black and non-binary students often lack these role models on campus. The data show that about 70% of bullying focuses on a student's appearance and, to a lesser extent, their race, gender expression, sexuality, and disability. So, schools with more diverse staff members who are trained to foster connection with students tend to have fewer problems with bullying. Kelly Jacob is director of High Tech Middle North County, a public charter middle school in San Marcos near San Diego. She says the teachers spend the first week of school working to help kids feel like they're in a safe space with friends and trusted adults.
You know, lots of schools, it's like day one, here's the syllabus, we're going to get to the math and science. That's super important. But before anything, you've got to help kids understand that they are valued and loved and respected and that they're in a school and a place that they want to be.
To make sure no one falls through the cracks, students at High Tech Middle attend a short advisory class first period all 3 years at that school. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
And finally, here is Ray Hamill, rounding third and heading for home with this week's sports stories, including news of a local team snapping a 21-game losing streak in style.
The local high school and college football seasons kicked off last weekend with several teams in action and a big victory for one Little Four school. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on that in just a moment as we look back at all of the opening weekend games and take a look ahead to what will be another busy weekend for the local teams, as well as all of the other big local sports stories of the week, including some high school soccer news, some local volleyball, and some motorsports as the Redwood Acres Raceway season begins to wind down. But first up, the opening weekend of the new high school football season did not disappoint, with several big performances, most notably by the McKinleyville Panthers. The Panthers came into the new season riding a 21-game losing streak that had dated back to the end of the 2022 season. But with new head coach Jason Benge calling the shots, the Panthers kicked off the new campaign with a big 28-6 win over Fort Bragg at McKinleyville High School. Senior quarterback Ruger Baxter was involved in all four of his team's touchdowns in the win, passing for three TDs in the second quarter alone and adding a fourth quarter touchdown on a QB sneak. Del Norte, St. Bernard's, and Eureka also won their season openers. Del Norte defeated Hoopa 20-6 in bizarre circumstances in a game that lasted almost 24 hours. The all-local showdown kicked off in Crescent City on Friday night, but had to be postponed just three plays in because of a county-wide power outage. The two schools resumed the game on Saturday evening at McKinleyville High School, with Del Norte winning. The game itself was a sloppy affair, thanks in large part to the circumstances, with too many mistakes and multiple touchdowns called back on penalties. Both teams posted a shutout in the second half, but Del Norte never appeared in danger of losing to the Little Four team and dominated the action with their relentless running game. Arguably the most impressive result of the weekend was the Eureka Loggers' 56-32 win over Arcata on Saturday night. The high-flying Loggers offense scored 8 touchdowns against the defending state champions, who graduated many of their key players after last year's historic run through the postseason. The fast start for Eureka suggests this is a team that could contend for this year's Big Four championship and return to the North Coast Section playoffs for the first time since 2018. The St. Bernard's Crusaders, meanwhile, comfortably took care of business against visiting Clear Lake with a dominating performance by their defensive and offensive lines. Quarterback Trenton Hagler and running back Riley Nance combined for almost 300 yards rushing in a 30-6 win, as the home team pulled away in the second half. The Fortuna Huskies were also in action, but lost 28-18 at St. Helena. The Ferndale Wildcats had a bye last week, but will kick off their season this weekend, playing at Fort Bragg on Friday night. 6 of the HDN varsity teams will be in action this weekend, with a busy Friday night in store for local fans. In addition to the Wildcats' trip to Fort Bragg, McKinleyville will try to keep its fast start to the new season going with the Panthers Panthers host St. Bernard's, while Del Norte will try to go to 2-0 when the Warriors travel to play Ashland High School in Oregon. Hoopa will also be in action on Friday night at Aetna, while on Saturday Eureka will host Shasta at the Redwood Bowl, where they will be playing their home games this season due to the ongoing construction at Albee Stadium. Several of the Mendocino County teams also will be in action this weekend. In addition to Fort Bragg's game at home against Ferndale, Willits will travel to play Piner, while the Ukiah Wildcats will try to bounce back from a season-opening 33-26 loss to Rancho Cotati when they host Carlmont on Saturday night. The South Fork Cubs, meanwhile, will have another bye this weekend before kicking off their season next week at home against Happy Camp. In local college football, it was a disappointing start to life in the National Division for College of the Redwoods. The Corsairs, who made the jump from the American Division to the more competitive National Division this year, kicked off the new era against Sacramento City College at the Redwood Bowl on Saturday and lost a close one 16-13. The visiting Panthers recovered a CR fumble on the opening kickoff and returned it all the way to the 2-yard line before punching it in just moments later, and that would ultimately prove to be the difference in a tight game. The Redwoods players will try to get a first win when they travel to play Foothill this Saturday, with kickoff set for 6 p.m. In local high school soccer, meanwhile, it's been an impressive start to the new season for two Little Four schools. The St. Bernard's Crusaders got the better of McKinleyville 7-1 on Wednesday, which was their second win over a Big Four program in 2 weeks, having also defeated Fortuna 3-0 in their season opener. The Ferndale Wildcats also are impressing early in the season, including a pair of shutout victories over Mendocino County Schools this week. After struggling in front of goal last year, this year's Wildcats team has hit the ground running, scoring 7 goals against Mendocino on Monday and 4 more against Fort Bragg on Wednesday. League play for the Big Four and Little Four girls teams gets underway in 2 weeks. In local college volleyball, a very young Cal Poly Humboldt team that features 11 freshmen will begin its season with 4 games at the Hawaii Challenge this weekend, while College of the Redwoods will continue its preparation for conference play with 3 games in Southern Oregon this weekend. The CR women are off to a 1-4 start under new head coach Macy Thomas and have had to overcome some early adversity with the loss of standout Quincy Collins, who suffered what could be a season-ending injury early in the campaign. And rounding out a busy week for local sports, the Redwood Acres Raceway season is winding down. Last weekend, Brandon White took the victory in the NorCal Legends Series main event at the local track. The 2025 Redwood Acres season will conclude on September 20th with the Steve Taylor Memorial Fall Spectacular. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks to our engineer, Michael McCaskill, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Susan Potter, and Ray Hamill. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Sigurd Bjørn. Thank you for listening.
KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commute. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org.
Redwood Community Radio is funded by Press Forward, a national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news.